Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, how Navajo elders are coping with a pandemic that leaves them vulnerable not only to disease, but hunger. We'll spend this hour with journalist Sunny Clutches-Chilly, who is Navajo herself. She says many of the more than 9,000 Navajo who have been infected with COVID-19 are elderly, lack running water and reliable transportation, and fall through the cracks of food distribution programs despite a deep cultural mandate to care for them. We'll talk about how people are coping with so much hardship, both its physical and emotional toll. Our conversation starts after a short break. What sort of conditions allow for a pandemic like COVID-19 to do maximum damage? Think about a place where lots of older people live in extreme poverty, far away from the nearest doctor's office or grocery store, without the internet to provide solid scientific information about how to stay safe, and in some cases, without even running water or electricity. Recipe for disaster, right? It's also reality for many elders living on the Navajo Nation, which has the highest per capita case rate anywhere in the U.S. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Sunny R. Clutches-Chilly is a member of the Navajo Nation herself. She's also a writing instructor at the University of New Mexico and a freelance journalist. She grew up steeped in a tradition that taught her to treasure and protect older people. And since the pandemic, she's heard a lot of messaging encouraging younger Navajo to take this responsibility seriously. But when she visited the Navajo Nation recently, she met lots of people who are clearly falling through the cracks, lacking not just for medical services, but water and food. Her reporting on the effects of the pandemic on Navajo elders appears in Searchlight New Mexico and in The Guardian. Sunny, welcome to Think.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You write that you've been thinking a lot about how things might be for your grandmother if she were still alive right now. What kinds of things would you be trying to figure out to make sure she was okay?
Gosh, I think one of the biggest things is, you know, my grandmother really enjoyed visitors. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of elderly Navajo people enjoy just that. And it's something that allows us to maintain that closeness that I also talk about. And I think that would be one of the bigger challenges. I mean, water, care, supplies, I think that would be okay in terms of her getting those things. But the biggest thing would be her understanding that we just can't do those kinds of things. That would be the biggest challenge, I think.
You write about a lot of families in more populous areas on the Navajo Nation. They have sort of open door policies, like if a friend or a family member wants to drop by, the door is always open to them. And that can't really be happening right now, right?
Absolutely. And it's been a challenge, especially when things have kind of lightened a little bit on the reservation. We're seeing less infection numbers, we're seeing less deaths, things like that. But it's still important for people to maintain that new sense of thinking where, you know, we still can't do that. We'd very much love to be able to open our doors to people, but it's really hard to do right now.
So you helped to take care of your grandmother as she got older and needed more help, and you wanted to make sure, this is so beautiful, that she yearned for nothing. Is it possible for you to tease out how much of that desire was about your particular relationship to her and how much is about the values of the culture you were raised in?
I think it's very much, they're very much intertwined. I mean, it was a given for me growing up that I was very well aware that this is my grandmother, this is her role, and it was just implanted in me very early on that that would eventually be my role, and not just for my grandmother, but for my parents as well.
Why does Navajo culture have a specific reverence for elders?
I think that something I mentioned in the column is just that, you know, they are ultimately our pillars to the culture, to the language, to the traditions that we still hold today. And really, without our elders, we'd be lost. We wouldn't know which way that we need to go and what we need to do to maintain these things that are very valuable to us.
Is there a clear delineation that marks somebody as an elder, or is it a status that people sort of gradually acquire and inhabit as they get older?
I think that it's something that you gradually fall into. I mean, like for me, for example, I just became a grandmother, though I'm not yet 40 years old. But traditionally, My sister's daughter is my daughter, and so her child makes me a grandmother, yet I am not an elder. I have not acquired that status just yet. So I think that it's a number of things. I mean, I'm definitely not an elder. My parents are in their 60s. They're not really elders either, but they are definitely great grandparents. So it's one of those things where there's not a clear-cut line.
So you were visiting your parents in Shiprock, where you grew up, and decided to check in on some older folks in remote areas around there. You visited this grandmother and granddaughter living in just incredibly tough circumstances.
Yeah, actually, my parents live near Shiprock, in that Four Corners area. But I did check in on those elders, and really just using local people to help guide me, and people who I obviously can't name, as I can't name them, and I didn't name them in the column. But I did. I spent a day or two out in a specific community, just visiting just the elderly demographic.
So, how did this grandmother and granddaughter get food and water?
Well, there's actually another person involved in this family, I should say, and the woman has a son, but he spends a lot of time away from the home, away from the family, working, and days at a time, she mentioned. And so she said that the groceries usually came from him, and of course during the week and in the afternoons they relied on the local senior center, which provided meals for the older woman. And so most of their food came from the son. When he did come back, he would always come back with groceries. But they also got water from a local water organization that's been helping people who do not have water and providing water for them.
Are these areas just so remote that some of these folks are living that it's functionally impossible to run water lines out there?
Well, there's a number of factors in that kind of tie into this whole thing. It can be difficult to understand and unpack, but for example, this woman and her grandchild, she about, I don't know, a couple of feet away lives another neighbor who has those amenities. But there are things within the Navajo Nation that have to deal with land use, with water use and permits and all of these kinds of things that factor into being able to have those amenities. And so for her, that was more the case. It wasn't that she was physically, I guess, the geographically unable to get water. It was other factors involved in being able to have access to that water.
That has to be frustrating to witness because we can't really imagine living without running water, especially in a time when it's so important to make sure that we're washing hands and that sort of thing.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm well aware of these contingencies and these issues that keep people from being able to access and have running water, but you know, it is frustrating when you're physically there and you see that you can walk to a house over and that person can take a shower, that person can has indoor plumbing, can wash their hands, can enjoy, you know, the little things like that that we take for granted a lot of the time, and then have this elderly woman and her granddaughter not be able to take a drink of water whenever they want to, simply because they might have to preserve what they have.
So you write in the piece, you've been a journalist for 20 years. This was the first time you had cried on a reporting assignment. I gather you weren't confident that they would be okay, this grandmother and granddaughter.
Yeah, it was hard because I think it was more what really got me the most was when you see an elder cry, it's hard because I imagined in that moment the one time that I saw my grandmother cry, and it was when she lost her first son. And they're so strong. Elders are depicted as being such strong people. And again, I refer to that reference as pillars. And it's for that reason they hold things together, especially elderly women, because we are a matrilineal society. And so when I saw that elderly woman was just at the bottom of the barrel and she had lost some of that strength, it broke my heart. And so that's what it took for me to really touch into those emotions that I had.
So, reading your work, I now feel like I carry concern for these folks with me as well. The part that got me was when you said, you talk to elder after elder who are living in really tough circumstances and that they don't complain very much, not because they're not suffering, but it sounds like that just hasn't done them much good.
Yeah, and I think that part was really paying homage to what perhaps a lot of people have been hearing about the Navajo people, is that there's resiliency. And I know maybe some people get tired of hearing that or have no real idea of what that looks like, but I think that in that column, that was kind of me showing what that looks like, that these are the conditions they live in. These are the types of things that they're dealing with. But gosh, they complained very little, but not only because they accepted it, because they knew that they were going to be able to pull through in some way and in some manner. And there's something else to that. It's that, there's an old saying that a lot of elderly people just express, and it's that the Navajo Nation is a very difficult place to live in. It takes a really strong person to live there, and they know that they have that strength within them. And I think that's where that part of the column was coming from or alluding to.
And what about this little girl who's 10 years old? You mentioned she's already a cancer survivor. Her grandmother's looking after her, but it sounds like this girl is also taking on some responsibility now for looking after her grandmother.
Oh, absolutely. It was amazing to see that little girl's strength, though she may not have known exactly what was happening out in the world and what was happening right now, or even why we were there. But she was just so full of spirit, and she had this sense of knowing what she needed to do. I mean, she was just yay high, but she had this great confidence and just ability to know that she knew her role in taking care of the two of them, just as the grandmother did.
You met a number of older folks who have either no running water or no electricity or neither of either one. How does that affect the kind of nutrition people are able to get, the kind of food they can keep at home?
Well, there's gosh, there's a long history of Navajo people in processed foods and having to maintain or keeping a diet that is not based in fresh foods. And so a lot of that stems because people don't have access to refrigerators if they don't have electricity. And then they can't cook if they don't have any water. And so a lot of the food that some of those people have who don't have access to those things are foods that can store well for long periods of time. So if you don't have water, that makes it a little bit difficult to cook. And of course, you can't have a daily water intake. And so hydration becomes an issue. And the same thing with food. I mean, one of the gentlemen in the story, I talk about how he stores food in coolers but has no ice. But to him, that's just the best that there is for him. He doesn't have electricity, so he doesn't have a refrigerator or a cooler or a freezer of any sort. So for him, it's like, well, I mean, I guess that's what I'll use my cooler for.
I'm thinking about, I mean, it might seem like a minor thing, but long nights with no electricity, that means, no getting online, no watching TV. What do people do with that time?
I think there's a lot of, and it's funny because my parents do the same thing, though they have those amenities. It's just, they'll sit outside and appreciate what they do have. And my parents do that. They see where it is that they've come, where it is that they hope to go, and they think about their families. They think about all of those things. I mean, the two older women in the story who are sisters, who I mentioned, they made the most of their time. They visited, they sat outside under the tree and talked about life, talked about what it was like to grow up. And then the gentleman that I talked to in the story, he did the same thing. I mean, when we got to his house, he was just sitting outside, and it was the middle of the day. It was hot, but for him, it was a lot cooler to be out there. And he was just thinking about life. In fact, he was thinking about how that community was once a great place to farm, but now the drought has taken that away. So they think of a lot of things, but I think mostly about the appreciation of how far they've gotten and what they do have, and not necessarily what they don't.
Is there some system set up to regularly check on folks who might experience a crisis but like don't have a phone to call for help or a car to drive to help?
I believe that the local hospital units have some sort of a system, but I think it's more geared towards the elderly. It's a system that checks in on them and to see if there's certain things that they need. But then the reservation is so vast, it is just so spread out that it's nearly impossible to reach every person. So an exact system, I would say no, but I believe there's something of a sort, but it still does not reach everyone.
My guest is Sunny R. Clutches-Chilligi. She's a freelance journalist and writing instructor at the University of Mexico and a member of the Navajo Nation. We're talking about her recent article for Searchlight New Mexico and The Guardian titled Navajo Elders Alone Without Food in Despair. You're You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Sunny R. Clutches-Chilligi. She is a writing instructor at the University of New Mexico and a member of the Navajo Nation. Her article for Searchlight New Mexico is called Navajo Elders, Alone, Without Food, in Despair. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Sunny, we should note here, the federal government has a legal obligation under numerous compacts to provide health care, education, housing, infrastructure, precisely the kinds of things that we're hearing so many people don't have right now. This might take more than the 40 minutes we have left, but how, after more than 100 years, are so many of these promises still unfulfilled for so many people?
You know, I think that it's, gosh, that's a very loaded question. I think that, you know, there's a lot of behind the scenes type of things that, you know, people don't realize, and being able to get these amenities and to get these necessities to people on the reservation. You know, I'll just take one example into consideration: water. To get water lines to people's homes, it's a very grueling process, and part of that is running water lines through other people's lands, because the Navajo people are allotted specific land measurements of land, and that takes the permission of all of those people's homes and lands who that water line goes through. And so there are things like that, and there are issues with the other aspect of the actual money getting there, but I think that a lot of the time the Navajo Nation is given either second thrift type resources, mm-hmm. or resources that are simply just not enough to cover that vast, you know, the vastness of our nation. And there are so many issues. It's just one of those things where it's like, it's built up over time, that once something does come in, it's so far behind already. And it's like, we need more resources because we've just kind of dug a big hole in terms of getting those resources in. So it's a million different factors. And, you know, that's the best that I can do in getting an understanding of exactly how that works and what is wrong in that aspect.
So there's not a good answer for the question. There is an answer to the question.
No, absolutely not. I mean, just now the relief funds that have been given to the government, there's issues in just figuring out where that will go. It's like, how do you decide what is most important right now where we could spend this money? And quite frankly, and I've said it before, it's not enough. It's not enough to cover and fix these disparities that we've had and that we've essentially collected and built on over time.
Another concern you have, particularly at the moment, is access to information. What is the link to the outside world for people on the Navajo Nation who live in remote areas?
The two big links are going to be the local tribal newspaper, the Navajo Times, which I used to write for a decade or so, and also the Navajo radio station, which is what I start my column with talking about. There's a station dedicated to Navajo people that is broadcasted in the Navajo language. And so that is the primary source for this elder demographic. Though some do have access to the newspaper is primarily published in English.
What's the story for children right now who may have to do school remotely?
Oh gosh, that's a disaster in itself. I mean, I've heard just in this first week for those BIE federal funded schools that are now open and requiring students to do learning remotely, some are having really terrible access to internet services. Some are having to drive to local chapter houses to access wireless internet. Some don't have the necessarily tools, meaning computers and things like that. But, you know, internet on the reservation is not good. And so this idea to try to do remote learning is just, you know, it was essentially a disaster waiting to happen. I mean, I just saw a photo the other day of a community that's part of the Navajo Nation, but in the middle of New Mexico, that where a bunch of kids were sitting out in the heat with an elderly person on the computers trying to do their homework. And that was just that I'm imagining that this is how it is all over the Navajo Nation now.
Margaret is calling us from Denton, Texas. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. I used to live and work up in northern New Mexico for many years, and I spent a lot of time in Farmington and Shiprock. And my question is, I don't know Do the Navajo benefit from casino gambling? I know that there's some casinos up there, and I thought at one point in time that the Navajo did not participate in casinos, but that they changed, and I'm just wondering, has that had an impact, or is that not happening?
Thanks for calling.
I think a lot of Navajos would like to know that question, the answer to that question too. Do we benefit from those casinos that have now popped up throughout the Navajo Nation? I am not aware of the benefits that Navajo people get from casinos that are now in place. That's a good question. I'm not aware of how that happens and how we are receiving the benefits of, you know, what's coming in through casinos.
You had a strange experience reporting on this story with some chapter leaders and sources backing out of promises to talk to you on the record about, like, food shortages and other ongoing problems. What do you think explains that reluctance?
I think it's accountability, because this was definitely a situation where it wasn't necessarily myself asking for the answers from these specific leaders. It was the elders. But I think that it was perceived to these people who did not respond or ignored our request for a response, that they were thinking it was probably something that I was kind of sniffing around for. But really, I was doing an act on behalf of the elders. They knew who was accountable for this. And in the column, it mentions that, you know, they thought it was leadership. They thought it was the community itself as well. And so that's why I went to ask those people, you know, what do you think about this? Because that's what the elders think. So I think that it was just more, I was really just looking for a response, because I felt like I was doing due diligence to these elders to find that response and to create some fair and balanced reporting. But it just simply did not work out that way.
I would have expected some of these sources to be, like, more likely to trust you as a Navajo journalist who understands the culture and the background, rather than somebody coming in from outside the community to report for a national audience. But that's sort of the opposite of what happened with you.
Yeah, and it's something that's been an issue for a very long time. I mean, I know the fine folks at the Navajo Times and the work that they do, and they face this issue for very many, many years. And the thing about people don't understand about the Navajo Nation is there's nowhere in any laws or in any rules of any sort that say that they have to respond to the media. And so we are put in a very, very strange place where a lot of times these kinds of stories are not told, because that's what we deal with. And so there's nowhere that designates that anyone has to respond to us. And the leadership and people who are aware of that definitely exercise that right to not respond to us.
So it's interesting, because you mentioned that you didn't use the names of some of the subjects. It's not like anyone in this story that you write about who is suffering has done anything that would, you know, ordinarily sort of put them at risk. Does that play into your reluctance to use their names, or their reluctance to have their names published?
It's a little bit of both, because, you know, I think Navajos in general are really private people for the most part, especially elders. You know, there's a notion that you just don't go out and say things for no particular reason. And the strange thing about this was, you're right, there wasn't necessarily that they were doing anything wrong, but it was just the mere fact that they were providing information about the situation. They knew there might be consequences to pay. And that just tells you a lot about their views and the relationship with the Navajo government. And so they did not have really any reason to want to be off the grid, or not to be named. But for them and for their safety, they've known from past experiences or other experiences that, you know, there could be consequences to pay.
So we've talked about the federal component of this, which is huge. But is the lack of assistance to people in need also reflective of a lack of resources at the chapter level, or is there something else going on? Is there some sort of diversion of resources that could be used by pretty vulnerable elderly folks but isn't getting to them?
I think that it could be a communication issue, because the anonymous sources who helped me drive the story, who are not the elders in the story, I talked at length with them, and though I couldn't use a lot of that because of the fact that they were not named, talked about how, you know, there could be funding. There is a lack of funding, but there could be funding if people could just communicate with each other in a manner that would allow for that to happen. But I also think that there are issues systemically. I think that we don't really have the best track record in terms of doing business on the Navajo Nation. I mean, you hear a lot about money coming into the tribe, especially with what's happened more recently and with the CARES Act and the funding from that as well. A lot of people have this sense of feeling that we're never going to see that. And that's something that we've known and a mentality that we've had for a very long time. We've come to an understanding that there's a good chance that we're not going to see anything that comes our way monetarily. Mm-hmm. And I think that has a lot to do with the functioning of the government and really how things work. I mean, and this is not just coming from me. I mean, my parents are very involved with and knowing what's going on the reservation. And so are other peoples in my family. And it's really disheartening to hear the Navajo people say that, oh, great, well, there's this money, but guess what? We're never going to see it.
It's a gutsy thing for you to be having this conversation with me, to be publishing this, not just in the Navajo Times, but elsewhere. Are there people who disapprove of you shining light on problems within the community that, you know, feels to some like you're airing dirty laundry that other people don't need to know about?
No, I've actually received the opposite in terms of comments for this. And I was waiting for that, to be honest with you. I mean, the days before we decided when we were going to run this finally, and believe me, it was a journey. I was anticipating that. I was really nervous because I have a lot of pride in where I come from. I believe in the Navajo people. I believe in what we stand for and who we can be and who we are. But at the same time, I also believe that everyone deserves the care, especially during this time, and especially Navajo elders. So I think that was the driving force for me. But no, I mean, I've gotten some wonderful comments and people thanking me, in fact, for doing this, because, you know, it's not every day that someone from that own community is trying to hold people accountable on behalf of a very vulnerable group of people in the Navajo Nation.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Are there structures set up to allow elders to sort of advocate for themselves when they have needs that are not being met?
I believe that the local chapter houses are the places where that would happen, because they do have it's a community gathering type setup. So there are things called chapter meetings where the elderly are usually the ones who are involved. This is not something where a lot of the younger demographics will find themselves in, because it's a lot of where the local government type of things happen. So resolutions are passed and things like that. Things are decided for that community or those communities in those forums or in those places, which are chapter houses and chapter meetings. But outside of that, I'm not aware of any in terms of not anything to my knowledge, but I think that's the only platform for that demographic.
What are some of the reasons? And I was really happy to hear you saying that case rates are starting to come down on the Navajo Nation. But what are some of the reasons you think COVID spread so rapidly through those areas?
I think the more obvious thing is, and you hear this time and time again, is the multi-generational homes. Mm. You know, I myself, at, you know, throughout my lifetime, can remember a time where, you know, my uncle lived with us, or you know, my sister, or, you know, just throughout our lifetime, my niece lived with us. And so there's very much homes that are like that. And so, and people obviously have to go out and do the work that they have to do. Somebody has to go and get groceries. Somebody has to go and, you know, be that person. And really it's a big chance to have to be able to have to do that for a family, because you just don't know if you're going to bring it home with you or not. And then of course there's all the other factors, you know, not having accessibility to water and not having transportation, like all of those things just all play a factor in exactly what happened with the rise in those cases. And so, and I think that a couple of other factors include the visitation thing. I know a lot of the older people were having a really difficult time early on understanding why we had to do what we were doing. And so, and honestly, I mean, we are an imperfect people as well. And some people were just not listening to the protocols or the precautions of keeping their distance, of wearing a mask, you know, things like that. And so there's just a lot of factors that there's not one main thing that drove these numbers.
I would imagine at first, as for many rural parts of the United States, people thought, well, this is something happening far away from us in the big cities on the East Coast.
Yeah, and definitely, I think my very first piece, anything having to do with COVID and the Navajo Nation, was in the New York Times, and that's exactly what I talked about how my mother, when this first started, said we went back to her roots, and she talked about how that was just the safest place that she ever knew, and by proxy, it was the safest place I ever knew. And now you hear a lot of Navajo people who have contracted the virus say, I never in a million years would have thought that this would be something I would fall victim to. Mm. Or we live so remotely. How the heck did it end up here? You know, so it's very understandable that you think that way when you grow up there, when you know just how far away you are from everything.
And yet you learned the Navajo Nation was also disproportionately affected a century ago in the flu pandemic of 1918 and 1919.
Yeah, and it's interesting because some elderly people that I know and people that I know who still have some elderly people in their family have talked about how at one point some elderly people have thought that, you know, this a pandemic is something that every 100 years is something that a Navajo community faces, that it's kind of the norm for it to happen because generations before ours, say like my grandmother, for example, lived and was alive during the last pandemic. And then now it's my turn. And so it's just like, you know, it's something that's bound to happen, that's going to happen, but that's why we learn from our stories. And that's another reason why elders are so important, because it was from those elders that we learned, we should have learned what we need to do during such cases like a pandemic.
My guest is journalist Sunny R. Clutches-Chiligi. She's a writing instructor at the University of New Mexico and a member of the Navajo Nation. We're talking about her recent writing, including a piece for Searchlight New Mexico and The Guardian called Navajo Elders, Alone, Without Food, in Despair. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Sunny R. Clutches-Chiligi, who is a writing instructor at the University of New Mexico and a member of the Navajo Nation. Her recent article for Searchlight New Mexico and The Guardian is Navajo Elders, Alone, Without Food, in Despair. You can join us on Twitter at KERA Think or by emailing think@kera.org, which is where we hear from Leslie, who writes, I'm a member of the Creek Nation, and so many of the issues you discuss are reflected in other nations, revering elders, local government versus BIA, importance of food, but the size and scope of Navajo lands or some other tribal reservations are unique. Can you discuss the cultural approach to giving and how COVID has impacted that?
Absolutely. I mean, and I think it starts with the situation of multicultural, multi-generational homes. You know, part of that giving is opening your doors. I can already imagine that a lot of elderly people were trying to open or allowing an open door policy for those children or grandchildren that they had, which is a very scary thought because you don't know where those grandchildren and children have been and letting them into their home. So I think that is an act of giving and welcoming people into your home. And I think another thing is that on the upside of things is that it's amazing to see how many different groups have organized within the Navajo Nation to help the people. And I think that is just, you know, it could be argued that that's just something that a lot of people do. They have that giving nature, but I think it's even more so on the Navajo Nation. I mean, I come from a family where, you know, you show up with something when you visit someone, and then you offer something to someone when they leave. And this is something that I learned from my grandmother two generations ago. It's something that my mother does, and it's something that I do. And that is something that's deeply rooted in the culture. You know, we learned that, you know, sending goodness with someone goes along with the act of giving. And so, you know, this story alone has generated so much other Navajo people and Native people in general who want to offer a helping hand in some way. And so I think that more than anything, what's happened and what's happening right now on the Navajo Nation, it's really just kind of highlighted our ability to do that, to just kind of dig deep and give, especially when it came to funeral expenses. I mean, lots of people have been setting up GoFundMes for those who have lost their lives to COVID, and so many people have been generous even within the nation itself.
So on the Navajo Nation, as in a lot of other places, traditional funerals are sort of out of the question at the moment. How would people typically mourn a death, and what's happening now?
Well, it's definitely, it used to be a process, and quite frankly, a process that was really helpful in the healing process. And so when someone would pass, the family or someone in the family or close to them would provide an announcement on the Navajo radio station to those listening who might have known that person or who has ties to that family, letting them know that this person has passed. And then they would announce a meeting. And so Navajo people are really big on these meetings because not only is it a chance to talk about this person and celebrate this person's life, but also it was a chance for the family to get help to fund these funerals. And so the people have really lost those two aspects. And I think a lot of people harp on the fact that it was more about, oh, we lose a chance to get money for funerals, but it's more than that. This traditional process, so to speak, though it has changed over time and it's not as traditional as it used to be, the funeral process, the now tradition, the more modern tradition of funeral services incorporated that kind of visiting aspect where having people surrounding you and talking about and having this one person who has passed bring you together, that was an act of healing in itself. And even more so, these were huge gatherings. I mean, this was a gathering to honor these people and this family that has lost this person. And now that's not the case. Now we have a limitation on how many people can be at a funeral site and be involved. I mean, people are getting really creative and having things like drive-by funeral type services where people are just parking up with their cars or driving by in a way to just show some type of respect. And so you lose that personal aspect, which is lost in all aspects now that this pandemic is here.
When people who reside on the Navajo Nation get sick enough with COVID to require like a ventilator, is there sufficient space? Are there enough beds on the nation to give them their hospital care there, or a lot of people having to sort of leave and go elsewhere?
Well, they start off with the local hospitals and care service centers, and there aren't many, and a lot of them are not equipped for as many people as the people who have contracted the virus and have so far needed to use a ventilator or other services beyond that. And so what happens then is the local government-run hospitals, the IHS services, they contract with border town hospitals. And so, for example, in Shiprock, in the Northern Agency, those people, when they don't have enough beds or people need more services than what that hospital can provide, will use one, say, in Farmington, which is about a 35-minute drive. Or if that's not working out, those people will be sent to Albuquerque, which is about three and a half hours. Mm. And so, and that's the same thing on the Arizona side, because this is just the New Mexico side. Same thing on the Utah side. We're having to use all of these outside services and institutions that are definitely not they're not nearby.
They're not nearby. And I wonder if they struggle to provide like culturally appropriate literate care.
Oh, I'm sure, because one of the specialties of the local hospitals is that they usually have a translator. And so there's someone there who's specialized in Navajo medical terminology. And so when you don't have that and you don't have visitors allowed into hospitals outside of the reservation, that could make things very complicated. So if you're the only person and you're a medical personnel in a hospital serving someone whose first language or only language is Navajo, it's really hard to comfort that person. Because especially in the Navajo language, because it means so much more in that language than it would perhaps be in English. And so there's definitely something lost in that respect.
It's always interesting when you try to translate one language into another and you realize that it takes too many words to say something, or you can't sort of perfectly express the kind of ideas that you have.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm always in favor of hearing things and being able to speak in Navajo, which I was able to do in this article, because there's so much more meaning in the language. And for Navajo, that's absolutely the case. I mean, when somebody calls you, you know, my son or my child in English, you know, like that's great. It's nice, but it means so much more when somebody can say shiyaje, you know, my baby, my love, my child. You know, it's the language definitely adds something to it. And, you know, I feel for the people who don't get to hear that, who are in hospitals because of COVID.
You've also written about younger people who are concerned about food shortages, people who are sort of setting aside the work they would normally do to start cultivating plots on their own land. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's just I'm not going to lie. I'm a little envious because I feel like I'm in this weird age bracket where, you know, I'm not young enough to do that kind of stuff anymore, but I'm also, you know, kind of in a position to do what I can with my reporting. But, you know, they're just amazing. I mean, I've heard of organizations, youth organizations coming together, groups of young people coming together to help those in their community. And I think it's great. I mean, they're showing an understanding of the culture and of that long line of tradition of caring for one another. I think it's wonderful.
How do younger people make decisions after they're finished with their education to stay where they were raised or to go elsewhere in the United States?
It's a battle. It's definitely a battle. I mean, I was first an undergraduate over 10 years ago and remember how difficult it was. You know, having an education is definitely very helpful, but I think it more valuable to be able to know where you come from and to maintain your language and your culture. So every person, I believe, who leaves the Navajo Nation does not make that decision very easily. It's a tough battle to decide, you know, do you leave behind a life that is almost nearly extinct, or do you try to maintain both of them, or do you just, you know, give in to this new life that you're trying to attain and these new goals? So it's a battle that young people have to go through. And it's one that, I mean, this is my third round in college as a PhD student, and it's a battle that I face daily.
Do you plan to return after your studies are complete?
That's the goal. But it's hard to say when things just change so rapidly. I mean, I'm going to use this story and this opportunity to write this story as an example. I left journalism last August, and here I am doing way more journalism than I thought I was going to do. I mean, I was really excited to venture and try new things, but being a storyteller is in my blood. It's in my culture and my tradition. And so I can't let it go that easily. And so I do hope to return. In what capacity, I don't know, but I'm excited to find out.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Do you feel like the rest of America is making any progress whatsoever toward understanding Native peoples and the unique place they occupy within the broader U.S. society?
I like to think that in light of a lot of things that's happened, I mean, I heard somebody say on Twitter the other day that this is the year for us, you know, and for me, I have mixed feelings about that, because a lot of the know that people have of Native American people nowadays, especially the Navajo people, is because of these disparities, is because of what the pandemic has done in shining light on these things. And so I would like for people to know that we are also a very resilient people. I would like for people to know that we are more than what they see on CNN or NBC or what have you, because a lot of that light is being shined on, you know, what disparities exist. So I think that there is more of a knowledge now of Native people, and that we are here, that we've been here, and that we're going to be here. But I would like to see a lot more of it.
It's a really interesting point that on the one hand, it's important to kind of recognize disparities and inequities that need to be corrected. But that's not the entirety of existence on the Navajo Nation or elsewhere.
Absolutely. And I've tried my best to not be too political about this. But, you know, I encourage all mainstream media outlets, you know, near and far, to take a look at what we have outside of COVID-19. Mm. I mean, we have some wonderful people doing amazing things that, you know, you don't hear about very often. We have them. Navajo people are in every capacity, every profession that you can think of. We're out there. And so are a lot of many other Native Americans. And it'd be good to see, you know, them get some of that coverage of the wonderful things Native people can do and who they are.
So You mentioned earlier that, you know, elders have been keepers of the stories of 1918 and 1919 and the influenza pandemic and how it affected the Navajo Nation. As a storyteller, I wonder if you've thought about how the story of COVID-19 might be told a century from now.
Yeah, absolutely. I've even thought about my role in being the person who to tell some of these stories. And so, and I think that that's probably why I came back to journalism. I'm very much an advocate for Native American people to tell their own stories, because right now we see a lot of, you know, again, mainstream media is telling our stories and sharing them. And I think that's great to a certain extent, but we are the ones who should control the narratives of what is happening and what has happened during this pandemic. And so that those who come after us are able to understand it from our own eyes, from our own perspectives as people who belong to those communities.
How easy is it right now to get a COVID test on the Navajo Nation?
It's a lot easier than getting one in the city. you know, I go back on a regular basis, and I haven't just yet, and I will in a week or so here, but I've said that it's a lot easier to get one there because you don't have to have symptoms. You don't have to have all of these requirements in order to get one. Whereas in the city, there's so much red tape. I mean, I used to be able to come back from home to the city and get tested out of precautionary reasons. But now I'm finding that that's going to be difficult because they are only testing if you have symptoms here in the city.
You mentioned that your folks still live outside Shiprock, and they're not quite elders yet, but they're getting older. Are you worried about them?
I worry about them daily. I worry about them very often when this virus hit. I mean, it was instinct for me to worry about my family, and that's why I went home. And I know a lot of Navajo people, they had the same thought. And so, you know, everything that I do, I make it clear that they are at the forefront, even coming back to school. I mean, I almost did not teach and take classes this semester because it was a matter of, am I going to expose myself by teaching in person, or am I going to be able to teach online and still look after my family? Because I knew that that was going to be a consequence. And so they're at the forefront, their health and their wellness is at the forefront of all of the choices that I make, because as their daughter, I am the person responsible for them.
Sunny R. Clutchess-Chiligi is a freelance journalist and a writing instructor at the University of New Mexico. She's a member of the Navajo Nation. Her reporting on the effects of the pandemic on Navajo elders appears in Searchlight New Mexico and in The Guardian. Sunny, thank you so much for making this time to speak with us.
Thank you.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you get podcasts by searching for KERA Think, or listen anytime on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.